Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, John Dennis here with News Desk, the daily podcast from Guardian Unlimited. It's Tuesday, February the 13th. Today, North Korea has agreed to move towards dismantling its nuclear capability in return for aid. Meanwhile, Iran's brushed aside threats of a military attack by America, but Britain supported the US claims that Iran's been arming insurgents in Iraq. In Lebanon today, bombs have ripped through two buses north of Beirut. The attacks are likely to fuel tensions between supporters and opponents of the Western-backed government. The Anglican Church is bracing itself for a historic split this week over the issue of gay clergy. And some of the most beautiful beaches in Wales and some historic sites too could disappear within 100 years, says the National Trust, thanks to rising seas and erosion. Well, shoring up our defences here in the pod is John Henley, who's going to be allowing us a sneak preview of The Guardian's diary, and Ros Taylor, who's got the best bits from today's papers. There's been a big step today towards peace in Northeast Asia. China has been the main player in hammering out a deal with North Korea. It involves Pyongyang shutting down its main nuclear reactor and eventually dismantling its atomic weapons program. There'll be face-to-face talks with the United States, and North Korea will also try to normalise its relations with Japan. Our Beijing correspondent is Jonathan Watt.
North Korea has agreed to freeze activity at its Yongbyon nuclear plant, which is at the centre of its weapons program. It has also agreed to allow international nuclear inspectors back inside the country to check that the freeze is going ahead properly. All of this must be carried out within 60 days for any further progress to be made. So essentially, that rewinds the clock, takes North Korea back to where it was at the end of 2002 when the latest standoff started.
What will North Korea get in return?
In return, North Korea will also get what looks very much like what it had before. 500,000 tons of heavy fuel, which will be provided by the United States, probably with some support from other countries. The big difference that it may also get economic aid at some point, and there will be talks towards diplomatic recognition. What does seem to be the difference this time is that on the US side, there does not seem to be any offer or any promise of providing a light water nuclear reactor, which is what was the case under the 1994 agreement that was in place. But of course, the really big difference in all of this, before the latest crisis started in 2002, North Korea was not a nuclear power. Now it is a nuclear power, but it's been able to get away without being punished in any way.
How has this deal been made possible?
This deal is definitely a good step in the right direction and has to be done. It's been made possible by North Korea feeling more confident now that it has proven itself a nuclear power. The United States has definitely backed down on several key points. It's eased the pressure it's been putting on North Korea in the past year or so. But absolutely crucial in all of this has been the role played by China, which has helped to bring together all of the six parties at the talks, has helped to persuade them that they must talk about this as the only option of getting any deal that obviously is the preferred option across the region, considering that the alternative is war or some sort of military conflict.
That's Jonathan Watts. Well, if diplomacy can get a result with North Korea, what about the other member of George Bush's axis of evil, Iran? The Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, expressed his belief yesterday that what he called wise people in the US would stop such illegal actions as a military attack on his country. But there are concerns in Washington at Iran's nuclear build-up and its involvement in Iraq. Ewan McCaskill is The Guardian's correspondent in Washington, and I asked him what evidence there was that Tehran was fueling the conflict in Iraq.
Well, they have a sort of 200-page dossier, but that dossier is classified, so no reporter has seen that yet. What we've had so far is a briefing on the contents of the dossier, and they're claiming that they've got explosives that would have come from Iran. They're claiming that these new roadside bombs that have had a devastating effect on the US and British forces in Iraq have come from Tehran, that they're the only people with the sort of tool machines capable of making these roadside bombs. And they've also produced the sort of tail fins of mortars, and again saying that this has come from Iran.
How has Tehran responded to these accusations?
Well, the President Ahmadinejad and others have said, you know, this is fabricated, it's not true. And the Iranian position is basically, of course, there's lots of Iranian weapons and explosives in Iraq. They fought the Iraqis between 80 and 88. Iran supplied anti-Saddam guerrillas. Some of the militias that operate in Iraq now were based in Tehran for 30 years. So, of course, there's Iranian weapons in Iraq. That doesn't mean, as the Americans claim, that a decision has been made at the highest levels in Tehran to support the insurgents.
Are Washington's claims credible?
Well, there's a lot of scepticism in Washington, but I think it's probably misplaced. There's so much scepticism because the Americans got it wrong in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003. Because of that, and they know that people are going to be sceptical, I think the Americans have been really careful this time. And it does seem to me, you know, conceivable that the Iranians actually are sort of quite heavily involved in Iraq.
Is the Pentagon preparing to attack Iran?
My gut feeling is no. There's not much support for an attack on Iran in Washington, certainly not in Congress, the Pentagon, or the State Department. The only person who seems to be in favour of it is the Vice President, Dick Cheney. But that in itself could be enough. But I don't think it's going to happen in the next few months.
Has the Bush administration given diplomacy a chance?
The Bush administration keeps saying they want this to be done through diplomacy, but there's not much sign of it. Condé Rice is in favour of opening negotiations with the Iranians, provided they suspend uranium enrichment, you know, seen as a first step towards a nuclear weapon. And surprisingly enough, she has the support of the new Defence Secretary, Robert Gates, so that's quite a strong combination pushing for diplomacy. Unfortunately, Bush has said, and I know this is a position up until just the last week or two, that he's completely opposed to entering into any negotiations with the Iranians. He's still scarred by the 79-81 hostage crisis. I mean, it's had such a terrible impact on the Americans of his generation. They've never quite got over it, so he is holding out against any negotiations with the Iranian government.
Are there any other arguments by neoconservatives for an attack on Iran?
Well, the neoconservative central, not far from the Guardian office here, is the American Enterprise Institute, and that's where a lot of right-wingers are based. And there are people on the margins of that institute advocating an airstrike against Iran. And you think, well, they're so far out of contact with the rest of, you know, sort of mainstream opinion in Washington. But Bush has listened to them before. He listened to them in the run-up in the war in Iraq when everybody else was suggesting let's have a phased withdrawal of troops from Iraq in the run-up to Christmas. Bush opted instead to listen to the people at the American Enterprise Institute and took on board their plan for a troop increase rather than troop withdrawal. But I just can't believe that he'll do it again.
Ros Taylor joins us in the pod, having had a thorough read of today's papers for us. Ros, a terrible day of violence in Iraq yesterday.
Another one, I'm afraid to say. Yes, 80 people died and around 200 were injured in an explosion, which seemed to have been timed to coincide with a 15-minute silence or pause in Iraq. And that was to commemorate a bombing a year ago of the Samarra Shrine, which The Guardian points out was when people really began to talk about civil war in Iraq.
Now, the Daily Mail's been fueling a people's revolt.
Yes, well, yesterday it was the Mirror, today it was the Mail. It calls it a great road toll fiasco. You may wonder how something that hasn't actually happened yet can be a fiasco, and the answer is that there's a petition being set up on Number 10's e-petition site, which anyone can sign, saying that national road pricing is a terrible idea and they don't want it, and about 1.2 million people have duly signed it. The Mail, of course, can't resist the irony of a petition against the government's own policy on the Number 10 website. but there's a lot of commentary about the idea, which is good, clearly, that people are beginning to debate it. But some economists in particular are very, very anti the idea of people being, as they put it, spied upon as they drive around and their movements registered, and they're being sent a bill according to how much time they spend on the roads and which ones they use.
More tech problems for the government in the shape of the database of patients using the NHS.
There are serious worries about this beginning to creep into the papers. There have already been scepticism about how such a big project can work, because it's basically putting everyone's medical history online or on a secure intranet. and it's going to cost £6.2 billion. Well, apparently one of the senior executives involved in the project, who works for Fujitsu, an IT contractor, told a conference recently that it, quote, it isn't working and it isn't going to work.
Now, newspapers love headlines about a new cancer drug, and not least The Times, which features one on its front page today.
This is a new drug called exemesane, which The Times says could save around 1,000 lives a year. Apparently, if postmenopausal women who've had breast cancer take it after taking tamoxifen, it improves their survival rates.
The socialist candidate in the French presidential election, Ségolène Royal, announced some policies the other day, and what's the fallout from that?
The fallout is a little on the sceptical side. A lot of people liked Royale's programme. It was 100 separate ideas set out in what she called a presidential pact. But she has got a lot of criticism for not spelling out how they're going to be paid for yet. The FT in particular calls it a colourful rag bag of ideas and criticises for her fairy tale approach to economics. The Guardian is a bit more generous. It says that really the point was almost the person who was setting out the plan and how she was setting it out rather than the detail. But yes, she does need to work out how to pay for all this.
At the BAFTA Awards the other night, 007 actor Daniel Craig was shaken and stirred by the sounds of it.
Oh, yes, yes, a classic headline there. Yes, Daniel Craig was not in a good mood. He didn't win any BAFTAs on Sunday night. But I don't think that was so much of the problem as the fact that people kept coming up to him, apparently, and congratulating him on how good he looked in his Speedos in that infamous scene, which only sadly lasts about 2 seconds. And I know, I've seen the film 3 times now. Anyway, so coming out of the sea. Anyway, one of the people who did that was Johan Hari, who is an independent columnist who just happens to be gay. I don't know whether that's got anything to do with it, but the Mail notes it. And he came up and said, oh, you looked really good. And Daniel Craig just snarled, apparently. And called him a word I can't use on the podcast, followed by the word fool, and it was all very unpleasant. And eventually a source close to the actor explained to the Mail that over the course of the evening he'd been getting increasingly wound up with people coming up to him telling him how great he looked. Daniel sees himself as a serious classically trained actor who spent 3 years with the RSC and brought real depth to the role of Bond.
Well, it never used to happen to Roger Moore, did it? Many thanks for us, and don't forget to subscribe to The Wrap. That's our daily email service, a review of the papers every day in your inbox by going to guardian.co.uk/wrap. At least 3 people were killed today when bombs exploded on 2 buses carrying commuters in Bic Fire, a Christian area of Lebanon north of Beirut. Bic Fire is the hometown of the former president, Amin Gemayel, and his family. Reporter Clancy Chasse spoke to me on his mobile from near the scene.
It's the hometown of the Gemayel family. The Gemayel family is the biggest Maronite family, the Maronite Christian family who were once the dominant sect in Lebanon. And the hometown of the former cabinet minister who was assassinated before Christmas in his car. His name was Pierre Gemayel. He was sort of the young hope of the Maronite Christian community. So it's hugely significant. It's seen by most analysts at the moment as an attempt to derail the tentative compromise reached between the opposition and the government, who've been at a standoff, really, for over 9 weeks.
Any idea who's behind today's attacks?
Absolutely no idea. At the moment, the only speculation is people who are looking to destabilise the situation. I mean, it could be fringe groups who serve the benefit from the current instability. It could very well be a Christian faction of some sort, because this is a rather closed community, and you'd have to have quite good knowledge of the area to infiltrate it and know where to plant the bombs. There is a lot of inter-Christian rivalry, and there is a history of inter-Christian bloodletting, certainly during the Civil War, but also much more recently when a national strike descended into riots and street battles about 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks today, I think. So there's certainly the potential for inter-Christian violence, and it's probably the most likely scenario.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, is in Tanzania, where he's presiding over a 6-day summit of the worldwide leaders of the Anglican Church. He's praying that the liberal and conservative wings of the Church's 77 million Anglicans can settle their differences, but a schism looks likely. Religious affairs correspondent Stephen Bates is in Dar es Salaam. I asked him how the Anglican Church had reached this point.
Well, it's the culmination here in Dar es Salaam of a long unravelling process which has taken place over the last few years over the issue of homosexuality, whether the church should be welcoming to gay people or whether it should uphold what conservative evangelicals see as biblical orthodoxy and say their practices are totally unacceptable, unbiblical and unchristian.
What's happening in Dar es Salaam?
Well, every 2 years, the archbishops of the Anglican Communion across the world, there are 38 of them, get together, and usually in the past it's been a rather congenial, gentle meeting for prayer, reflection, meeting each other, discussing issues of interest to Anglicans across the world and their provinces. This time, it looks like a crunch meeting because the developing world archbishops have said that they want nothing to do with the American church, and some of them are pretty sniffy about the Church of England as well. And because of the historic importance of the Church of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, by tradition, presides over this meeting, and he's got a hell of a job on his hands this week.
Do you think it'd be possible for him to reach some sort of compromise?
Well, it's very hard to see what the compromise will be because they've been dancing around this issue, as I've said, for some time, and really nothing has presented itself that would accommodate both sides happily in the same church. And a lot of people, including a lot of Americans, saying maybe it's better to drift apart because there is no middle way between those who absolutely condemn homosexual practice and those who say that homosexuals are people who the church can accommodate and should listen to.
If there is a split, what are the implications for the Church of England?
Well, it's very hard to see at this stage. The Church of England General Synod is meeting in a couple of weeks' time, and funnily enough, because it seems to be an obsessive interest, we'll be discussing issues of homosexuality and civil partnerships. And there are clearly factions within the Church of England. Some conservative evangelicals want to stick with the developing world church. Others would prefer actually to go with the Americans and Canadians. And it's quite conceivable that the Church of England will be riven with the same sorts of splits, and there will be a difficulty of accommodation between them. And if that's the case, then it calls into question the whole establishment status of the Church of England, which is held for 400 or 500 years since the days of Henry VIII. It's a moot point whether a divided church, a church which is splitting apart, can represent the official religion of England. And so all things are up for grabs at the moment.
Including the authority of Dr. Rowan Williams.
Well, Dr. Rowan Williams's authority has been pretty well shot to pieces over the last few years. Before he took up the job, he was regarded as a liberal on homosexuality. Since he's been Archbishop of Canterbury, he's had a much more difficult task. And frankly, his behaviour when he forced the gay Bishop of Reading, Geoffrey John, to stand down because of complaints from evangelicals after he was appointed with Dr. Williams's blessing in 2003, means that he's lost his old friends and supporters.
Now, John Henley joins us with The Guardian's Diary. John, I understand the Diary's got a timely piece of news considering it's Valentine's Day tomorrow.
Absolutely, that's right, John. Yes, we will be announcing, thanks to a particularly fine article in the Birmingham Mail, the advent of special male-only belly dancing clubs in Birmingham. Dance teacher Magali Penoel, age 26, promises, it says here, to trim down the porkiest tummies, achieve ramrod straight backs, and turn her students into sex gods with her undulations.
Excellent.
So, come on, guys, it's time to show her you really love her. We will, I think, then be moving swiftly across the other side of the pond for the news that the saga of the astronaut accused of trying to kill a rival for her colleague's affections and driving 900 miles in a nappy, I'm sure you recall, that emerged last week has been optioned for a film by Granada America, the US office offshoot of the ITV company. We'll be wondering, I think, probably, possibly, what took them so long. we'll then, I think, be bringing you some alarming news, courtesy of The Third Sector, the public sector magazine, and its back page paper round section, which may hold an important clue as to the recent alarming rise in animal terrorism, one of our favourite topics, as you're well aware. Anyway, this magazine cites figures from Mammals Trust UK showing that some 50,000 squirrels are killed on UK roads each year. It would seem then that revenge attacks may be a plausible motive. Mammals Trust UK paints an even more worrying picture for other species: 25,000 foxes, 50,000 deer, 800,000 rabbits, and 3 million pheasants, all killed by drivers each year. So it would seem to us that terrorist squirrels might just be the tip of the iceberg. And finally, we will be applauding whichever worthy sub at the Daily Mirror yesterday came up with the memorable phrase, "Did you know David Cameron at Eton or Oxford?" Call the Mirror News Desk on 020-7293-3831. Don't worry about the cost. We'll call your butler straight back.
Don't phone the Mirror. Phone us instead. No, instead, don't phone us. Email us, diary@guardian.co.uk. The National Trust has added its voice to the calls on policymakers to act to stop global warming. The Trust's publishing a report today into the erosion of the beaches of Wales. And there's no one in Wales that's more than 50 miles from the shore. And a crucial industry is tourism, of course, which depends on its lovely beaches. I asked The Guardian's Stephen Morris what today's report says.
Well, the National Trust says that over the next 100 years or so, they're thinking that the sea level, as many climate scientists are, they're thinking the sea level is going to rise by up to about a metre. That means that lots of beaches that are there at the moment, they say, won't be there in the same form in the future. They also say that climate change is going to cause many more storms and rising and flood tides and so on, which could sweep away beaches, change where the beaches are at the moment, really.
And it's not just beaches that are going to be affected.
Well, that's right. They also talk about things like precious salt marshes, which at the moment rely on salt water coming in, but they don't want to be completely flooded. That would be disastrous for the ecosystems there. Also, very precious sand dunes in places like the Gower Peninsula in South Wales. They're saying that they might, the elements might force them back. In some cases, they've got nowhere to go because they're close to cliffs, so they will disappear in time as well.
And there are some archaeological monuments as well, aren't there?
Yes, there are. They talk about around 50 historic buildings and archaeological monuments. Things like wonderful Iron Age forts that at the moment are kind of teetering on the brink. And in 50 years, 70 years, whenever, when these high seas come, might just sweep away the cliffs and they fall into the sea as well.
How is this research carried out?
Well, they base their research on information coming from scientists employed by the government, or at least funded by the government, who are looking at how high the sea is going to raise if global warming takes effect as they think it will. Then they're just simply applying that through computer modelling and so on to the bits of coastline that they own and seeing what that would mean for those particular areas.
Why is the National Trust focused on Wales in this report?
They think that over the last few years there's been a lot of attention given to places like East Anglia, low-lying areas of England, and indeed the southeast of England. But they think that people are forgetting that Wales can be affected. They say that people think of Wales as a very rugged, very tough coast. But they're saying that the rises in the sea will just alter precious areas there as well.
The National Trust owns more of the UK's coastline than anyone else, 150 miles of it. Is there any action the Trust can take to protect our shores?
Yes, it was quite interesting what they were saying about this. They're very much against building hard, concrete sea defences. They say that simply shifts the problem elsewhere, further down the coast. They're talking about different ways of managing the inevitable, really. In some cases, they say nature will just take its course and precious things will disappear. In one case, a village in North Wales might just disappear. But they're also trying to look at ways of clearing land behind dunes, that kind of thing, to give those dunes more room to migrate backwards.
What does the National Trust want politicians to do about this?
They want them to come up with some coherent policies here and now for the next century so that we're well prepared for whatever happens.
That's Stephen Morris. Well, today's show is produced by Francesca Panetta and Phil Maynard. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.